The moon, being the most prominent celestial body in the night sky, has legends across every culture. Often paired with the sun as a sibling, the ancient Incas of South America thought of the moon as the maiden sister, while the Luhya people of Kenya thought of the sun and moon as quarreling brothers.
A human.
That we, as mankind, could look up to the sky and see ourselves. Centuries ago, the Aztecs called the moon Mictlantecuhtli and believed it traveled through the night skies, hunting down victims to consume. The Maori people of New Zealand referred to the moon as man-eater. It seems we as a species see the moon as a reflection of ourselves, or something to be feared, or both. The moon famously dictates the tides, and any number of myths would have us believe it has a direct effect
on us.
Doesn't seem impossible. The human body is roughly 80% water. So perhaps the moon works its mischievous magic by somehow disrupting the alignment of water molecules in the nervous system. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, suggested that the brain was the moistest organ of the body, and because of that, the most susceptible to the influence of the moon. The Greeks imagined Selene, the goddess of the moon, riding her silver chariot across the night sky every night. The Romans adapted their myth, renaming her Luna, which becomes the Latin root for the words lunacy and lunatic, meaning someone who goes crazy with every phase of the moon.
Kind of like a werewolf.
Whether the moon is to blame, there have been stories about the duality of man for as long as there have been stories. Perhaps it takes the moonlight to reveal our darkest halves. As a culture, we seem to have trouble reconciling our darker impulses, like they're somehow removed from our animal origins. Sadly, we know all too well that when tragedies strike and people kill people, often the response is to call the perpetrator a monster, inhuman. Because how could a human be capable of such vicious cruelty? Such malevolence. The point of society is to remove the need for violent actions, those we once needed to survive. Hunting for food or fighting for social dominance. Now civilized, when man kills man, it causes a panic. Historically, the hysteria around witches and werewolves developed around the same time. In Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, some people were even accused of both. The ground had been set, as legends of lycanthropes are found in dozens of cultures across history. From the legend of Lycaon in ancient Greek mythology, to Navajo skinwalkers, or the werewolves from early Nordic folklore in the saga of the Volsungs, to the Irish Fáilad, or Cynhyrhoid. Before the werewolf entered popular culture as one of the universal monsters, the myths and stories of wolfmen range from punishments and curses passed down to men and women whose special abilities allowed them to transform at will. Larry Talbot, the title character in 1941's The Wolfman, is the former. After coming to the rescue of another werewolf's victim, he's attacked and becomes the next in line of the curse of the feral werewolf. In this episode, part one of our look at werewolves, we're going to be talking about the original Universal classic and the legends that went into shaping the myth of the werewolf. In part two, we'll talk two more modern werewolf classics, The Howling and Dog Soldiers, as well as some of the real-life basis for the werewolf lore.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
So going all the way back, maybe the beginning, who knows exactly where the first crossovers of man and wolf lie, but we're going to ancient Mesopotamia.
Yes, we are, and we're going to the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Okay, Old Gilgamesh.
Yes, that's how the kids refer to him, Old Gilgamesh. but in this Akkadian poem, Ishtar turns a shepherd into a wolf, and then that man, as a wolf, gets eaten by his own dogs, and that's the end of that.
So one of the first instances of, well, we'll say lycanthropy in this case.
Sure.
We're going to be using so much terminology.
I know.
But that it being a curse upon a person. And
yes,
here there's
as a punishment.
Sort of tragic irony where a shepherd is turned into the thing that he's trying to protect his flock
right.
from.
And then his trusty dogs eat him, and that's a sad, sad ending.
So one of the more common terms and one of the places that where you get the original language from is ancient Greek mythology, where werewolves made an early appearance in the legend of Lycaon. According to the legend, Lycaon would make human sacrifices to Zeus, you know, as you do. Those sacrifices happen to be child sacrifices, and that rubs Zeus the wrong way. So as he's known to do, he takes human form, he goes down to Earth, and gets welcomed into Lycaon's home, where Lycaon, I think, has a sense that something's up. And
right.
so he tries to serve Zeus in disguise, child
yeah.
pieces. And
as
Zeus is outraged. You know, he'll have all the affairs in the world as a mortal.
But don't serve him, children.
In disguise. But don't try and serve him, kid.
That's just rude.
Well, I mean,
they
Zeus or no.
They have to be at least, like, 15.
They're old enough to marry. They're old enough to be sacrificed.
Okay.
So Zeus is so offended at being served child that he curses Lycaon. And as his punishment, he turns Lycaon and his two sons into wolves, establishing early trends with cannibalism and also, again, the
right.
idea of this being a curse put upon man.
Now, when Ovid goes and describes this story in Metamorphosis, it's not only that they're wolves, but they're man-shaped wolves. And so that becomes very important in the idea of the werewolf. It's not
yeah.
just like oftentimes in Native American Navajo lore, you'll have a wolf man, but he's
right.
a wolf.
As skinwalkers who transition at will.
Right, right. But this is very specific to say this is a wolf, but in the shape of a man. In 1st century AD, Petronius writes a tale of a slave who is visiting his mistress, and a soldier is accompanying him. As they go on this trip, the soldier who accompanies him kind of starts turning into a wolf man. That's kind of how this story, it's not a great story, but
it's like surprise.
Yeah, and then they go to his mistress's
wolf,
house, and now there's wolf people. but it's not the greatest kind of story, but it is something that is there. I thought that was interesting, and it stood out because the guy's name who wrote it was Petronius, which made me think instantly of Harry Potter and the Patronus
yeah.
charm, which is the animal that you perceive and you defend the bad guys with.
Right. Do they point the wand and say Patronus?
Well, they say Expecto Patronum. Don't be a nerd, Darren.
I didn't. All right. I know that it comes up in the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes.
That's the extent of my knowledge.
It's the best way to ward off Dementors. But I thought that was kind of interesting. Petronius is that guy's name. I don't know. Maybe that's where she got it from.
I'm sure it had some connection, yeah. When it came to popularizing the idea of the werewolf, enter Marie de France. Long before Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein or Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, Marie de France was writing tales of werewolves. She was a 12th century poet and author, possibly the first French woman to have her poetry published. She single-handedly helped popularize the idea of the cursed werewolf who cannot control his own magical change. Because of her wide readership in France and England, Marie de France had a major role in changing the story of the werewolf as popularly told. She made the werewolf a victim of magic, a change from the older tradition of a man intentionally changing himself. The setting for Marie's story is the Celtic world, embracing England, Wales, Ireland, Brittany, and Normandy. Her story plays out as early magical realism, and the werewolf is a tragic figure, sympathetically portrayed. Sounds pretty familiar to the movie we're about to discuss.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of interesting, the idea of werewolf, the name itself. Were is Anglo-Saxon, meaning man. Wolf, obviously, is a wolf.
I didn't know that. I wonder because, not that I've watched it, but True Blood kind of plays fast and loose, and there's were animals in general. They're cats and panthers.
Because were means man, so you can be a werecat. Kind of interesting, the idea of shape-shifting people has been all over the world. They have it everywhere. In Japan, they're actually werefoxes, and I think that's adorable.
Yeah, that sounds way cuter. Although, I guess historically, the tales told... The werewolf is not necessarily a malicious figure. It's often just kind of like the way Marie de France describes it, is a tragic figure who often becomes the prey of man hunters.
Right. Much like the wolf, which we'll get into in our second episode.
Yeah.
There's also were jaguars. Jaguars, if you wish.
Half man, half car.
Yes, exactly. And in Russia, there's actually, in Russia and Siberia, there's were bears, which is adorable. Because that's probably how they get them to ride those bicycles.
And play ice hockey. I don't know if you've seen that one.
No.
So it's fitting that we're talking about werewolves and the moon shortly after the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 lunar landing. Not unlike the lunar landing, any association with werewolves and the full moon is a very modern twist.
Yes.
I thought that was interesting. I grew up thinking it was the full moon you had to look out for.
Right. But they seem to be able to do it whenever they feel like it. Old werewolves.
Right. Or, well, I guess in even the, like, cursed werewolf, it just... Moonlight period.
Right.
We used to have a teacher in our school. I never had him.
Who was a werewolf?
Well, he would take off, say, like, if... I think he would take off the day of a full moon. You know what? Now that I say it out loud, maybe he was more about maybe it was more about paganism than werewolfism. But but the students used to joke that, like, oh, we looked at the calendar. It's going to be a full moon tonight. We don't expect to see the teacher that day.
How does he have that many vacation days?
Well, it's one. Well, I mean, probably sick days. I don't know. I mean, it's one a month. I guess sometimes
I feel like, much like the tale of the werewolf, this has been blown out of proportion.
Kids do like to gossip. But yeah, so on the note of werewolf movies, and we're going to get to The Wolfman from 1941, because that is kind of the archetypal classic, but it wasn't even Universal's first werewolf movie.
No.
And in my opinion, not their best.
I know you hate it. I remember like having dodged this one early on in our history together.
Yeah.
And now having to watch it.
When we first covered the Universal Monsters, I think it was episode 2.
Yeah.
We kind of split up. There's so many movies. So we kind of split up. I did The Wolfman.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was pretty angry at it.
Yes.
You did The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
Which has come up in books recently. We'll talk about that down the line. So I've revisited The Wolfman, but I've also revisited Werewolf of London, the 1935 Universal picture. It wasn't as commercially successful, so they didn't continue down that line, but it established a lot of the norms that we associate with werewolf movies. I think it's a better film on account of its star. There are elements in Werewolf of London that go on to popular culture. The idea of being able to kill a werewolf with a silver bullet doesn't actually happen in The Wolfman, but there it is in Werewolf of London. Again, you've got a sort of tragic figure who's doing his best to sort of manage his new werewolf lifestyle. But yeah, I just wanted to mention Werewolf of London because I think I do like it, even though I have revisited The Wolfman a couple times now, and I like it more than I originally did.
despite
visually,
Lon
it is
Jr.
Not a pretty film.
You don't think so? It's not as varied as like the other Universal classics, especially going back to like Dracula and Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein.
I think that's the thing for me. Dracula, Bride of Frankenstein, Frankenstein, there is this, I think you look at it and you say that's Universal. There's a very slim, smooth kind of look about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wolfman, the 41 Wolfman, there's a lot going on in it, even visually. Like, you have some of the Foggy Moore kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
but it's not so gothic, and it's not so
It does feel a little bit more
grand.
Like a soap opera.
Yes. Yeah. It reminds me a
like
lot of when I was rewatching Dark Shadows.
That's not
soap
that's
opera
not a visual
quality is absolutely
not a compliment for their visuals.
No.
So one of the things that I do prefer if, Werewolf of London to The Wolfman are the effects. It's funny. I will reverse my opinion when it comes to werewolf aesthetics, because in Werewolf of London, we've still got it's old Jack Pierce. It's Universal's monster maker. Jack Pierce initially tried a design similar to what wound up being the Wolfman, but the studio was concerned that it was not anthropomorphic enough mm-hmm. and would challenge the censors. It would be too scary. It's funny to think of the Wolfman image as too scary. It to me, it kind of looks like a lot of like
pubes
painted
stuck on people.
I was going to say cotton balls, but all right, pubes. but just kind of mashed. It looks like they put glue on his face and rubbed his face on a barbershop floor.
I feel like that's what they did, yes.
In Werewolf of London, it's closer to the Curse of the Werewolf, the Hammer film, or even Monster Squad is a more recent variation of that. But it's you see more of the humanity in there.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion does change when it comes to like trying to scare people. Then you want to go away from any sort of
right.
anthropomorphism.
I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing about the idea of the werewolf is that Mary Shelley told us exactly what Frankenstein looks like. Very descriptive. It's right in there. Bram Stoker, very descriptive of his Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
We know what Dracula, we know what Frankenstein, so then his bride would look like. We just know this because it was told to us by the originator. Werewolf originated by all people. You know, it's kind of like the first time we see it is the first time probably anyone's really put it together.
Yeah, and as Universal does, they've got carte blanche to change whatever they like.
Right.
So, yeah, it's ever-changing. Enter the Wolfman from 1941, directed by George Wagner, who made a few monster movies and went on to have a pretty extensive career directing television, including Maverick, the 1966 Batman TV show, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E., written by Kurt Siodmak. I'm sure I'm butchering that last name, but in any case, he wrote Universal's Black Friday with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. As well as Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, I Walked with the Zombie, and a lot of other genre stuff. Starring Lon Chaney Jr., who's playing Larry Talbot, the Wolfman, it does beg mention that not his real name.
No.
So there is a bit of tragic symmetry to Lon Chaney's life. He's a serviceable actor, but, you know, he's not winning awards. His name, Lon Chaney Jr., it was a stage name. The studio pushed it on him because of the recognition of his father, Lon Chaney, the man of a thousand faces, who died right before they were making the original Dracula. He was born Crichton Tull Chaney.
That's a great name.
That's the name
of a monster man.
Right. But, I mean, recognition is what they were going for. But Crichton, I wouldn't give it to a child, seeing as how it sounds real close to Cretan. We're saying Lon Chaney is a mountain of a man.
Yeah, no one's making fun of him.
No. Well,
or it's like a boy named Sue, and he got real tough.
Yeah, that sounds about right. He does see, I think in our first take on Universal Monsters, I called him a big galoot.
Galoot.
But yeah, so there is a tragic symmetry to Lon Chaney entering the Universal Monsters canon because, you know, like I said, he wasn't a theater-trained actor. He was a guy who needed a paycheck. And when the studio said, like, this is your role, it comes with the name change. And so he compromised and he changed his name to be in the pictures. And so the Wolfman is this sort of, you know, someone who inherits both this curse and in the story, he's the prodigal son returning, but he's kind of cast off the family business up
to
this point.
But I think, you know, that's the idea of a werewolf. At the heart of werewolf lore, it is this duality of man. It is our baser selves, our basic selves, rather, I should say, our basic selves fighting our sophisticated, domesticated selves. And that's the idea of that werewolf. And so I think that's why oftentimes during some of the things we'll talk about in the second episode, but during that werewolf panic time, it was like, we can't explain why people are doing these violent, feral acts, and that's, then they called them werewolves.
Right,
They're just like a wolf.
We're like 1.4% away from chimpanzees, but everybody's in a tizzy. Like, what is this? Where is this behavior coming from?
Wolves. It's the wolves.
Playing his Welsh father, we've got Claude Rains, who Rains is famous from Casablanca, yeah. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Lawrence of Arabia, and Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious. And before the Wolfman, he was already introduced to the Universal Monsters roster as Dr. Jack Griffin, a.k.a. the Invisible Man.
Claude Rains is good. He's a class act.
He is kind of, yeah, he's the core of this movie.
Yes.
And I mean, he's too good. I'm going to say he's too good because standing in contrast with Lon Chaney Jr., also Lon Chaney Jr. is about a foot taller than his father. And he's coming into the story after 18 years in America where he's lost any vestige of his accent. But Claude Rains, too good. We've also got Bela Lugosi playing a very small role as a gypsy.
Named Bela. Using that Hungarian.
I will not disappoint you, my lady. Will you step inside, please?
We've got Evelyn Ankers playing Gwen Conliff, the antique dealer, who gives us a nice bit of exposition over the wolf cane, the pentagram, and the curse of the werewolf.
I'm glad she was there, though, because I kind of needed to know these things.
This story is so heavy with exposition in the first, I counted, the first 14 minutes, we get three different go-arounds
of werewolf
lore.
It's the exact opposite of Dog Soldiers. Zero exposition, 100%.
There's an old poem. Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night
may become a wolf when the wolf bane blooms.
And the autumn moon is bright.
So you know that one too, huh?
Of course. Everyone knows about werewolves.
Literally, it could have just been a person with a book, like, reading a story, this Wolfman, and showing pictures of Wolfman.
The story literally does open on the page of the book and talking about the Talbot Castle
just
and the tragedy.
Just give that book to Claude Rains, let him read it to us, and I'd be satisfied.
How much better would it have been, if we kind of, like, you know, he's sitting in front of a fire reading a book, and he looks up, and he's like, oh, hello, and he, you know, kind of gives us some...
I didn't see you there. Join me for some evening reading about werewolves.
Never mind my son. rounding out the cast, we've also got Ralph Bellamy, who, another American actor, suspiciously placed in Wales. But Ralph Bellamy is famous from His Girl Friday, Pretty Woman, Trading Places. He's one of the old guys who makes the bet who isn't Don Ameche. He plays the chief constable of the Welsh town with an American accent.
You know, at least they didn't try and have a Welsh accent.
I thought that might be the only thing that could be worse.
It would have been bad.
If actors were really going for it, like Keanu Reeves and Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah. The synopsis is as follows. Upon the death of his brother, Larry Talbot returns from America to his ancestral home in Wales. He visits a gypsy camp where he is attacked by a creature of folklore and infected with an horrific disease his disciplined mind tells him cannot possibly exist.
Yeah. So
I tried to make it a little more like exciting, but that's the gist of it.
Psychology comes into the story a surprising amount.
Actually, a lot. More than I thought it was going to.
Yeah. And for a 1941 movie, that's unexpected.
Yes, because it's, again, exploring these ideas, this duality. One of let's say Claude Rains is more apt to believe what's going on, whereas Lon Chaney Jr. is very factual.
Yeah. And so we're going to talk more about like the realities of lycanthropy and the sort of extensions that, that sort of, well, exist in reality. But here, so the screenwriter Kurt Siodmak, his original script for the film didn't show a werewolf. In the original idea,
he could maybe have not have been.
It was all in his head. Yeah, they kind of played with the idea that we would never see the werewolf because one never existed, because all of this was the, you know, the machinations of the character Larry Talbot.
Which I would have loved, but that's far too, I think, advanced for a monster movie in 1940.
Yeah, it's way too cerebral, especially like the goal was to make a monster movie and making a psychological thriller in 1941. It's like, yeah, it's asking a lot.
Also, Jack Pierce would have been like, excuse me, why am I here? Make him look tired.
So the script was revised accordingly, but there still are those really interesting notes where, because the werewolf that first, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, but because that first werewolf attack, we don't find a werewolf. We find Bela Lugosi's corpse. I mean, they don't show it because it's 1941,
right.
But when they really explicitly explain, he's been bludgeoned to death with something heavy.
So explicitly.
They find a dead man next to a gnarled woman, and then we've got Larry Talbot, who's brought into his home with a wound, except he wakes up without any wound.
Right.
And they're explaining to him, it's like, oh, you beat a man to death last night. And he's like, I did what now?
Well, excuse me, what happened?
Is this your stick? Well, of course. That's the one I killed the wolf with.
Larry, Baylor the gypsy was killed last night. They found your stick by the body.
You mean Baylor, the fortune teller?
Mm-hmm.
What? I only saw a wolf. He bit me. Look here. Well, that's funny. It must have healed up.
Larry, Paul wants to ask you some questions.
Well, sure, go ahead.
No, I think we ought to leave him alone.
What's the matter with you? Paul wants to question him. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, go ahead. But don't try to make me believe that I killed a man when I know that I killed a wolf.
Yes, yes. We're all a little bit confused.
It's kind of a cautionary tale about walking around drunk.
In a blackout.
In a blackout in the moors in Wales.
Yeah.
Which probably happens more often than not.
So the story is about outsiders, and I think for that, Larry Talbot coming to Wales, speaking the way he does, just being general outsider, coinciding with the gypsy camp setting up shop, there is this element where like everybody's looking at strangers suspiciously.
Right.
All right, jumping into the story content. Larry's dad is an astronomer. He's got a pretty fancy telescope that Larry helps fix. I guess a piece shows up at the same time as Larry does.
What have we got there?
It's from London, sir.
And I guess in the original script, Larry Talbot was not Larry Talbot. He was a stranger who was an engineer there to set up the telescope and just kind of gets roped into the story. Makes a lot more sense with that goddamn accent.
Yes, that would have made a lot more sense.
So Larry, being the creepy weirdo that he is, uses that telescope, looks into town, into a woman's window, watches her changing, putting on, you know, her earrings and her setup for the day, and he's taken, and he's got to go into town and go check her out.
Well, you know, once you've spied on a person, really.
That's first base, right? That's
that is. That's 1941 first base right there.
Don't you remember? On your dressing table up in your room.
In my room?
Yes. Would you mind getting them for me?
Well, were they not for sale?
Well, I can't say that I blame you. They look so well on you.
Well, perhaps my father can help you. I'll call him.
No, that won't be necessary.
So Ralph Bellamy plays a friend of the family, another, you know, American expat who's also a pretty high-ranking constable, although in this small Welsh town, like how much crime could there actually be? He does seem kind of incompetent.
Right.
I think his early character, I think even in His Girl Friday, he's kind of a doof.
He's a doof.
Yeah.
That's a good word for it. He is doofy. I think what I like to think of it, though, is kind of that early Wes Craven idea of the bumbling officer.
Yeah.
I think he's a great kind of archetype for that.
Yeah, yeah. There's something to that. Which is interesting in terms of the town where everybody else seems to know what's up, especially as it relates to werewolves. We hear the classic poem.
Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night, they become a wolf when the wolf moon grows and the autumn moon is bright.
So basically there's nothing you can do. If it's your time to be a wolf, it's going to be your time.
Yeah.
So you could walk drunk or not.
It's a nice turn of phrase. And I guess it's catchy enough that everybody in this town seems to know it and be able to recite it on hand.
Well.
But I mean, even his dad, even Talbot Sr. talks, like, just recites it off. Like, he's not looking at his book when he says it. He's just like, yeah, everybody knows. And that is kind of how they treat werewolf lore in this story. I was thinking, if you were your average moviegoer in 1941 going to see this movie, you're probably not all up on the werewolf lore. And so in the first 14 minutes when three different characters are just like, yeah, werewolves, everybody knows this poem, everybody knows about Wolfsbane, like, where
it's
were
funny,
you?
Because it's the opposite of zombie movies today. Because in zombie movies today, no one's ever heard of a zombie.
No.
It's never happened. But here in The Wolfman, everyone knows.
Yeah, there's something's up with this town.
I also feel like when I was watching it, everyone knew this poem and lots of people were saying it. I grew up in a town with a serial killer, but we didn't have any cool poems. You know,
we'll come back to that.
You know that. I've said that a million times.
Serial killer?
Yeah, he's a serial killer. He's a child killer.
There were issues with you, like, playing as far as the road.
Because he was a murderer.
Because he was a child murderer.
Yeah.
All right.
He murdered older ladies, too, like 30-year-old women, too.
Okay, we'll put a pin in that.
Anyway, I feel, like, cheated.
So Larry effectively stalks Gwen Conliff and it doesn't really convince her to go out on a date so much as force his way into her hanging out with her friend and going to visit the gypsies. Because as much as, you know, society hates the gypsies, they're always good for a laugh or a good fortune telling.
Yes, they're always good for a fortune telling.
Yeah. And so the girls were going to go out and have their fortunes read, and Larry, you know, throws himself into that mix and makes it a trio. Her friend gets her fortune read by Bela Lugosi,
right,
who sees the star. And I think this part is complete invention. Like, this isn't even based on any mythology. I think the idea of, like, the person seeing the star on the next victim of the werewolf,
yes,
I think that's how it's supposed to go. So Bella kind of has a freak out where he's just accepted fate that, like, yes, this woman is going to be the next victim. And hey, go figure. Bella is the werewolf.
Yeah.
And to start the story off.
He's like, isn't this crazy? The world is crazy.
And he's like, I'm reading your fortune. It's not good. It's not good.
I wonder if you were a fortune teller and then someone comes, because probably people only, I mean, in this, they seem to just go for fun, but like, in the real world, let's say, people are only going because they're expecting bad news or something.
I think people often want to be reaffirmed that, like, good things are coming to them.
Do you think, like, they would go to a fortune teller for that? We need to go to a fortune teller. You and I need to go.
That'd be fun.
We need to see how this is.
I would totally do that. But yeah, in this case, Bella sees something bad. He insists on being paid in cash. So, yeah, so that friend is not long for this world. She is attacked. We hear a scream. I don't remember if the wolf howl accompanies it, but Larry is the consummate hero who goes towards the screaming, bringing with him the cane that he's just purchased from Gwen. And the cane's head is a silver wolf.
Right.
And when he finds the attack already in progress, he proceeds to, like, fight with this bear / wolf. It turns out it was Lon Chaney Jr.'s own dog that he was fighting in that scene. So he could sort of roughhouse and it looks realistic. But depending on the camera angle, and again, it is 1941, so we've got a certain amount of censoring happening. It's happening behind a tree.
Yes. Honestly, it's probably for the best, because you wouldn't really want to see a man beating a dog with a cane. right?
No, I mean, I would not. But yeah, so I guess, I mean, it's pretty violent. His takedown of this dog is pretty violent. And in the process, he also does get bit. So when they do what? I think the Gwen who he left eventually does find him, but so does the gypsy woman who's now on like on the horse and carriage and pulls him away and brings him back to Talbot Mansion. So now we're off to the races. Now, right. Like, we have initiated this story. We are rocking and rolling.
Jenny Williams, what about her? She's been murdered, sir.
Ralph Bellamy is at the house with Talbot Sr., Claude Rains, when they announce that Larry's been attacked. A gypsy woman left him at the door, and there's been a murder at the gypsy camp. Ralph Bellamy goes,
Wolf, gypsy woman, murder? What is this?
What makes you say she was murdered?
Her throat, sir. Come, let's look into this. Yeah, show me what had happened. I'll send Dr. Lloyd to John.
Maybe one of the strangest, like, I really wish I was there for, like, let's take that one more time, Ralph.
Now, this time, lean on wolves.
Remember, you're confused. You've never heard any of these words before.
What is this? But the thing is also, why is he is he surprised that there are gypsies? The whole thing, it makes no sense.
Maybe
you know
as the constable.
There. Everyone knows they're there.
I don't know. Maybe as the constable, like, this is the first time he's hearing about the gypsies in town. And he's just like, I didn't approve of that. What are gypsies doing in my town?
Well, sir, it's 1941. I can tell you exactly what they were doing.
Fleeing.
For a better life, sir. In your shitty town.
So the wolfsbane mentioned in the poem is aconitum, I'm guessing, based on how it's spelled. But it's been used since ancient times as a poison. It was put on spears and arrows for hunting and battle. As wolfsbane, it was believed to repel werewolves and, well, real wolves. The ancient Romans even used it as a means of execution.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In Navajo lore, the skinwalkers sometimes would come in and drop shit on your fire that was a crushed up flower, crushed up skin and crushed up flower.
Ooh.
And then the toxic fumes would kill you, so you had to watch out.
Oh, wow.
I don't think they had the wolf's bane. I don't think. It's a very lovely flower. It's only in UK.
Yeah, it's pretty, but deadly. I was curious about the idea of, like, a flower that blooms at night. And there's several of them.
Yeah.
There's the night-blooming Sirius, or Queen of the Night, which is a cacti. There's evening primrose, which can reach up to 4 feet tall and recedes prolifically. And there's the evening primrose, which has a wide variety of medicinal and culinary uses. So evening primrose you can eat. Wolfsbane, don't.
Don't eat that. I will say, just a little side note here. In German poetry, when you see a flower that opens up at night, it means like sex and an affair.
That sounds very Georgia O'Keeffe-esque.
Yes, but it's like only flowers that open up at night. Ooh. Very good, Goethe. Very good.
So when Larry comes to the next morning and has trouble sort of justifying anything that happened the night before and really has no evidence for any of it, but they do find his cane at the scene of the crime and he, you know, confesses because he doesn't think he's done anything wrong.
Right.
Except for beat a dog to death.
He beat Bela to death.
There's no crime in that, is there?
The wolf was Bela.
You think I don't know the difference between a wolf and a man?
Bela became a wolf, and you killed him. A werewolf can be killed only with a silver bullet, or a silver knife, or a stick with a silver handle.
You're insane. I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
So Bela's mom is the old gypsy woman who brings Larry Talbot back to the castle. She seems to have taken it in stride. Then we get a little bit of a monologue where she's kind of talking to Bela's
coffin. Well, he was a wolf.
Coffin. Right, and again, like the idea that, you know, he's probably, I mean, you're supposed to be eternal if you're a werewolf, right? I mean, they usually die of unnatural causes.
Yeah, I would say so.
But so maybe it's his final release, like maybe he's been around so long.
Yeah, because he was cursed, just like Talbot.
Right. Yeah.
They don't want to be werewolves in this.
Yeah. Yeah. It is this. Yeah.
It's melancholy. Not like a cool vampire.
No. That is interesting. Yeah, I remember in our Universal Monsters episode, we talked about the idea that, like, Frankenstein, you know, is kind of exemplary of life eternal. Like, you can always just keep shocking them or doing the process. And certainly vampirism is kind of this, you know, key to eternal life. But werewolfism, in being this sort of curse passed down, is always alive with somebody.
Right.
So when Larry checks himself to where there used to be a wound, now is that same star shape on his chest. And, I mean, a little heavy-handed, but there is something to the persecution theme in this story with the outsiders and the gypsies and the idea that, you know, a star marked on a person is a pretty specific reference to the Holocaust and persecuted Jews. And it's not a coincidence. The screenwriter talked pretty specifically about his own experience in Nazi Germany and, you know, the idea of living this normal life in Germany until one day it's all thrown into chaos and his family is on the run.
Right.
Not unlike Larry Talbot.
Not unlike the gypsy people.
Them too.
But they didn't get stars. The Roma people actually received triangles.
I didn't know that.
If they received anything.
Well, I guess he wants to have a conversation with the gypsy woman. He sits on a suspicious conversation between her and the coffin of Bela.
Yeah.
And so it's starting to inform.
Which is a good thing she likes to talk out loud.
She really, everybody in the story is chock full of exposition, whether they know it or not.
Just, I didn't like any of these movies this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We didn't,
outright
say it.
I was really irritated by pretty much every movie.
Aw, that stinks. Do you generally find that, like, you like a werewolf
star? I'm not a werewolf kind of gal.
No?
I think Howl was kind of like a fun take on werewolf.
I watched Howl, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, other than that, no. I like the Wolfman in Monster Squad.
Wolfman's got nards. Come on, come on.
Yeah, that was
he
good.
He has nards. Other than
Mindy
that.
Mindy needs nards to really appreciate a monster.
No, I'm not a werewolf person, I guess.
I do like a werewolf. And I think seeing Monster Squad at such a young age, like, yeah, I thought they were always going to be that good.
Yeah.
They are not. Like, no. that is a very perfect, abbreviated story of a werewolf. He is a cursed man. He doesn't want to harm people, but he knows that that moon's going to come out and the people around him are in danger. But Larry Talbot, yeah, he's kind of, like I said, he's a doof.
Yeah.
Well, he's not the doof. I mean,
no.
Paul, but, yeah, they're not. Not great. I even watched the Benicio del Toro remake of this. It has its moments. It's just not very good. I think it's tough to do this sort of singular cursed person werewolf story and have it really compel. But yeah, I like the idea of werewolves as more of a community thing.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that in part two. But yeah, this singular character, there's something that's missing, I feel. Like, it's certainly never scary.
I feel like it's not scary. I also feel that it wouldn't have mattered one way or another. He was always going to be the werewolf. And so why do I even care at all?
Yeah. And as far as, like, the fear factor, and it's really interesting that, like, I listened to a couple podcasts with older types, and the impact that seeing the Wolfman had on them, like, changed them. Like, they really loved the aesthetic and the dynamic, and I don't like either.
So I'm rereading It, and Richie, they go to a double feature, I Was a Teenage Werewolf in another film, and eventually then It becomes the werewolf that Richie sees.
Right, right.
And I just can't imagine seeing that and being like, oh, that's scary.
I mean, I suppose if you were really young, there's,
yes,
like, there's some snarling involved. But I mean, as adult horror fans, the first transformation takes place, we're looking at feet. Like, Larry feels it coming on, takes a seat in his slacks and, you know, sleeveless undershirt, and we see his feet get hairier and hairier, and then eventually, like, he's got wolf feet, and then he twinkle toes, walks on his toes away.
That's so funny.
I could practically hear the, like, Flintstones cartoon sound underneath.
Yeah, Jackson has, my husband has hairy feet. And I will say one time he hid under my bed. He was trying to play a trick on me, which don't ever sneak up and scare me. He was hiding. I had a lofted bed in college, and all you could see were his hairy feet. Yeah. And I did get scared. That did scare
me. Like, there's a hobbit under my bed.
Exactly.
Also of note, there's a wardrobe change that, I mean, I'm not an ultra continuity nerd. I don't need it for believability. However, Larry Talbot goes from light-colored slacks and a sleeveless undershirt to a black-on-black, like, essentially, like, Dickies, like a mechanic's top and pants that are black. So Wolfman had a wardrobe change before hitting the street.
Well, he had to put on pants that fit. His other pants probably got torn up.
You think? I always wondered we always do get the Wolfman, like, barefoot. And I kind of assumed that, like, the Incredible Hulk, like, the shoes are the first thing to pop when you do turn.
Well, yeah, shoes aren't going to fit on those tiny little paws.
Well, in this case, they're pretty big. Like, although, I mean, he does try to sell it by walking on his twinkle toes.
Have you ever tried to put shoes on a dog? They hate them.
Yes, I guess I have. I mean, I've helped. The comedy comes in when they start walking with those shoes on.
You know, that's what this movie could have really used.
Larry Talbot kicking his legs out to the side, awkwardly moving forward.
Shaking his feet.
Look of humiliation on his face. Why'd you do this to me? I know there's salt out there, but I'd rather bear the salt. So what follows is the classic men giving chase. It is a hunt. Larry Talbot doesn't know, like, he can't control himself, and he feels terrible about it, but there's really nothing he can do. So we are, you know, I don't want to talk specifically, but Larry Talbot does return in a number of Universal movies. So even though he's, treated unkindly with silver, he does live to fight another day.
Unkindly.
we actually talked about Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, right? I mean, they're all
in
it.
They met all of the Universal.
Right,
yeah.
But the movie, yeah, I think, was that our 100th? No, it was close to
50?
Maybe it was 50. Yeah, with at the time Miskatonic Musings. We talked about it, like, early horror comedies, and yeah, that was another one that didn't really float our boat.
No.
That was not a favorite.
Hated it so much.
But so we'll start to close it out there. Again, I did like this better the second time around. I do kind of appreciate this, you know, tragedy befalling Larry Talbot. His, you know, I think he might, you know, Lon Chaney Jr. might even get better as the series goes. He appeared as the Wolfman in, I think, like, 6 different Universal Monsters between the Abbott and Costello movies and, say, like, Wolfman meets Frankenstein.
Well, he's an imposing figure. He's like a Kane Hodder sort of guy, big freaking guy. I don't mind him as a monster. I hated this movie. I thought it was so boring.
Look, lady, if you're trying to scare me out of here, you're not getting very far.
And I hate being told all the things. It really irritates me.
Yeah, there's not a lot of... Yeah, I mean, it is kind of spoon-feeding a 1941 audience. I'm curious. I mean, it would maybe be a Patreon feature, but maybe you might like Werewolf of London more.
We'll have to check that out.
I do think it's a better movie. But that said, that was the classic 1941, The Wolfman. And in part 2, we're going to be talking about dog soldiers and the Howling, as well as a number of historical accounts of attacks, people who think they're werewolves.
Maybe they are.
I mean, who am I to say? I wasn't there.
Yeah, right.
And the psychology behind werewolves, and yeah, it's coming soon. So stay tuned.
As always, you can find us on all the social medias. We are on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We still got to figure that Instagram out. What does a podcast do on Instagram?
I just put up a video of me hiking, but I sped it up to look like the Evil Dead.
I liked that. That was good. That was a good use of Instagram.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, very nice. So we are on Twitter. We are on Instagram. We are Rance Macabre. You can find us on Gmail. Drop us a line. Tell us about your werewolf experiences. Why not? We're at therancemacabre@gmail.com. You can check out our site, therancemacabre.com. And as always, if you're finding us on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, any of that stuff, leave us some reviews.
Yeah, thanks. Give us some stars. And this is the first time I'm mentioning it on the show, but we're now on Bandcamp. So the album I put out in 2016 that's got a track with Mindy, as well as I'm also putting up the dance song on Bandcamp. Yeah, you can find us on Bandcamp. There'll be links on the show notes. So, yeah, that'll do it for me. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Stop.
The Rance Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated. And curated.